Despite the unrest, Robert and Ellie's wedding was scheduled to proceed as planned. Nicole had taken great delight in making preparations. The only blot on the joyous occasion was that Katie did not attend. Walking down the aisle in the central hall on Richard's arm, Ellie looked resplendent in her white dress. Nicole fought back tears, but when she saw them glistening on Ellie's cheeks, she could control herself no longer. George Mishkin had prepared an eclectic ceremony at the couple's request. It was short but elegant. Dr. Turner and Ellie exchanged rings and recited their vows with strong, positive voices. Dr. Turner then lifted Ellie's veil for the traditional kiss. A shot rang out, followed instantly by another. George Mishkin pitched forward, and the best man, Kenji Watanabe, collapsed beside him. Max Puckett was able to disarm the Bayat assassin, but Watanabe and Mishkin were dead. When it seemed as though the uproar could get no worse, a colonist burst into the hall screaming, "A Bayat just went mad and killed Yulianov!" And chaos ensued. Panic swept the colony. 3 hours after the massacre, Nicole and Richard were back at home watching news reports. 5 or 6 Bayats had simultaneously gone mad, and as many as 11 of New Eden's most prominent citizens had been killed. Attempts had also been made on the lives of Ian McMillan and Toshio Nakamura, but according to the newswoman, the attacks had fortunately failed. Bullshit! Nakamura had those attacks staged as part of his plan, said Richard. We should both leave. But even if you won't, Nicole, I am. I know what Nakamura's people have done to the Bayats. They'll be after me next.
I understand, my darling, but someone must stay to fight them. We must not submit to their tyranny.
Richard quickly packed as much food and water as he thought he could comfortably carry. When he was ready, he held Nicole tightly against him. He did not even say goodbye to the children. He was afraid that seeing them, he might change his mind. In the deepest part of Lake Shakespeare, there was an open entrance to a long submarine channel that ran under both the village of Beauvoir and the wall of the Earth module. Richard knew that it was the only way to escape Nakamura's people. During the design of New Eden, Richard had stressed the importance of an emergency exit from the colony. Richard swam carefully through the tunnel, slowing down every several minutes to check his air supply. When he reached the end, he moved through a series of locks that left him eventually in a dry subterranean passage. He opened the round door in the passage ceiling and cautiously eased himself out onto the central plain. Richard started in the direction of the other habitat. It was late. Certainly all the humans who were working at the probe site would already have finished for the day. When he arrived at the site, he verified that no one was there except a watchman Bayat, which he easily avoided. Richard threw his small pack into the opening in the wall and then crawled through himself. The passageway was narrow, and he had to inch forward on his stomach. His body brushed against the walls and the ceiling with every movement. His elbows, knees, and even the top of his balding head began to bleed. As he squeezed through, he heard a soft pitter-patter in front of him. Moments later, they were all over him. Richard spent seconds of absolute terror before he realized that the tickling sensation was caused by the leggies. One even straddled his nose. He tried to brush it off, but only succeeded in bumping his head again. He began squirming around to shake off the leggies and somehow managed to make forward progress. With the leggies all over him, he crawled the final meters to the entrance into the avian annulus. And as he was emerging, the leggies jumped off and disappeared into the darkness. Despite his fatigue, Richard wasted no time in scaling the wall that led to the module interior. When he reached the top, he wrapped his climbing line securely around his waist and descended 60 or 70 meters down, using the small ledges on the inside of the wall as footholds. When he reached the end of his climbing line, he took his flashlight out and shone it downwards. He could not see the bottom. Instead, he could see the wall extending far, far below, and what appeared to be water where the wall finally terminated. He thought he saw shapes and forms off in the distance, but he couldn't be certain. He began to shout. Suddenly, there was light in the habitat, and Richard was so startled that his feet slipped and all his weight was on the climbing line for a few seconds. As soon as he was secure again, he surveyed the world now unveiled in front of him. The source of the illumination was a great hooded ball hanging from the ceiling of the habitat above a brown cylinder, perhaps 1,500 meters tall, which stood in its center. There were no windows or doors on the outside of the cylinder, and no light escaped from its interior. An array of small white structures formed a ring around the cylinder, and a narrow circular canal surrounded the ring. Outside the canal, a large region of what appeared to be growing things, primarily green in color, occupied most of the rest of the habitat. The ground in the green region sloped down from the canal to the 400-meter-wide moat that was just inside the interior wall. "We have reproduced a small earth in New Eden," Richard found himself thinking. "This must represent in some way the home planet of these creatures." Richard pulled out his binoculars and studied the brown cylinder in the distance. "What secrets do you hold?" he wondered. He then searched the skies for some sign of the aliens. Nothing. After 4 hours, the light disappeared. Then he thought he heard a faint flapping of wings. Avians. The creatures inhabiting the structure were Richard and Nicole's old friends. With no warning, he screamed at the top of his lungs, and then truncated the scream abruptly. The flurry of wing sounds died out quickly, but for a second or two they were unmistakable. Richard was exultant. "I know you're there," he shouted gleefully. "I know you're watching me." Leaving his rope and clinging to the wall with his hands, Richard started down, ledge by ledge, in the dark. From time to time, he would hear wings again, but when he knew he was about nearing the moat, he heard his observers fly away. Then the avian habitat was again illuminated. Just as he was edging into the water, a pair of avians flew at him. They were frantic. They jabbered and shrieked and acted as if they were going to tear Richard apart with their talons. The avians hovered above him and herded him back onto the wall. These two were slightly different from the ones that he and Nicole had encountered in Rama 2. They had velvet body coverings, just like the others, but this velvet was purple. The single ring around each of their necks was black. They were also smaller than the other avians and much more frenetic. "So perhaps they're younger," Richard thought. "I want to go with you," he said, pointing at the brown cylinder in the distance. Then he had a brilliant idea. He managed to get his portable computer out of his pack and punched the keyboard. "Come here," he said to the two giant birds. "I have something to show you." Richard held up the monitor, which displayed the complex computer graphic he had used to convince the avians to carry Nicole and him across the cylindrical sea so many years earlier. It was an elegant graphic showing three avians carrying two human figures across a body of water in a harness. "That's it," he said as the creatures approached tentatively. "Come over here and take a good look." Richard did not know exactly how long he had been living in the dim room. His routine had been the same day after day, and he had quickly lost track of time. He slept in a corner of the room. Whenever he awakened, whether from a nap or a long sleep, two avians would enter from the corridor and hand him a manna melon to eat. In his solitude, Richard's greatest challenge had been to retain his mental acumen. He had begun by doing mathematical problems in his head. Worried that the sharpness of his memory had decayed as he aged, he started to reconstruct the major events of his life. Of particular interest to him during these memory exercises were the huge gaps associated with his odyssey in Rama 2 during the voyage from Earth to the Node. Once, after a meal of manna melon, he suddenly recalled a large ceremony with many avians. He remembered a fire in a dome-like structure and all the avians wailing in unison. One day, as he walked for exercise around his cell, he noticed that the door to his prison was open. He walked out and came to a small storage room where 8 or 9 manna melons were neatly stacked on shelves. "I get it. They've expanded my prison. From now on, I'm allowed to obtain my own food." Next, Richard found a room with running water. He drank heartily and washed his face. Then he walked down a corridor past a large room where 4 avians were sitting in a circle, passing a set of polished sticks back and forth and jabbering. "What is going on here?" Richard wondered as he continued to walk. "Am I no longer in prison?" 6 weeks had passed since Richard had found the door to his cell open, and he was feeling dejected because, although he had freedom, the avians basically ignored him. While he was speculating on the protocol for obtaining permission to depart, an avian Richard had never seen before came to his room. This avian had 4 cobalt blue rings around its neck and a deep black velvet covering. Its eyes, Richard thought, were very sad. The avian began to speak, and Richard, who through his observations of the avians had mastered some of the rudiments of their language, knew he was hearing the oft-repeated combination for "follow me." Richard was escorted to a huge elevator. He descended in it by himself. The journey seemed painfully slow. When the door opened, he was certain that his heart would jump out of his body. 2 strange beings stood in front of him. Each had a large milky eye on either side of its head, and each had an additional 2 eyes attached to long stalks growing from its head. The creatures were standing upright on their back legs with 4 front appendages neatly tucked against their smooth, cream-colored underbellies. They communicated with each other in a high-frequency noise that originated from a small circular orifice below their eyes. Richard felt dizzy and dropped down on 1 knee to steady himself. When the creatures motioned him out of the elevator, he discovered that he was in yet another manamelon storehouse, but one with technological equipment much more advanced than that of the one on the avian portion of the cylinder. A mechanical cherry picker was moving on a rail system installed in the ceiling, grasping individual manamelons and loading them into freight cars. The creatures bounced off down an aisle, and Richard followed, running to keep pace. "Mermacats, that's what I'll call them," Richard decided after dismissing cat ant and cat sect. He settled on mermacat upon remembering that someone who studies ants is called a myrmecologist. Apparently, the avians and the myrmecats do not live together. At least not completely. But they both use manamelons. What exactly is their connection? They led him through a corridor to a vast chamber with 3 pools, 2 of which were filled with a creamy liquid. About 100 myrmecats were in this room, some swimming in the pools, some sitting on the ridges dividing the pools. But were they actually swimming? The creatures did not move around in the pools. They just stayed submerged in a given spot with only their stalk eyes above the level of the liquid. At the next stop, he watched high-technology machines grinding up fibrous material and then mixing it with water and other liquids to create a slurry that looked like the creamy liquid in the pools. One of the aliens put its fingers into the slurry and touched the material to Richard's lips. "They must be telling me that the pools are for feeding," Richard thought. "So, they don't eat manamelons after all. Or at least, they have a more varied diet." Richard next followed his pair of tour guides up an escalator and into a vast factory where myrmecats and machines engaged in a wide array of tasks. In a corner of the factory, a myrmecat operator was presiding over an automated manufacturing process. Long, skinny, jointed pieces of light metal or plastic came into the area on a conveyor belt from one direction. Small spheres entered from another direction. Where the 2 belts merged, a machine descended on the parts with a peculiar sucking sound. Some seconds later, the Myrmecat operator caused the machine to withdraw, and a pair of leggies scrambled off the belt.
So the Myrmecats make the leggies, Richard thought.